Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm here with my co-host, Isaac Beal. Hello, Isaac.
Hey, Gail. Thanks for letting me co-host with you again.
It's great to have you here. You're getting to be a pro. Isaac is one of our interns this summer, but he's getting quite good at this. We've got a lot going on today, so let's get started. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Susan Guiazda, the public relations officer for the City of Ames, who will be here for her monthly segment. And Isaac, you're going to have a segment for us. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I have a story on the public piano project that is being brought to the Ames community by Patricia Isbicki, an Iowa State graduate student.
That sounds like it'll be interesting. I've seen that and heard that in other cities, so it's neat to know that Ames is going to have something like that. But first, to start off, we're very glad to have with us Matt De La Peña. He is an award-winning author who gave several talks yesterday at the Ames Library and signed a lot of books. But he was kind enough to get up early to be here on Local Talk. So welcome, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Just to give our listeners some background, if they don't know your work, you've written several young adult books. And your most recent work is a picture book. Some of the titles are Ball, Don't Lie, Mexican White Boy, and We Were Here. Great titles, by the way.
Oh,
I love the titles. So I was reading up on you online, and I read that you once said that you write for the kid in the back of the auditorium. What do you mean by that, and why is that the kid you write for?
Well, I guess there are two answers to that. The first one is, I think I used to be that kid. You know, I would be in the back of the auditorium thinking that that wasn't my haven, school. But there's another reason. When I go do a talk, you know, and I'm looking out at, like, say, 500 kids, I have to get that kid to pay attention. It's like my main goal as an author, but also as a speaker. And I think these kids, you know, speaking for myself, growing up in a working class environment, I feel like those kids, and I'll say us, we need stories and narrative, I think, more than anybody, just because we're taught to be tough, you know, not to let emotion enter into the picture. But I think stories are like a secret place for those kind of kids to feel things.
And I had the opportunity to go to your talk yesterday, one of your talks at the library, the one that was geared toward young adults.
Okay.
I believe. And you mentioned there that you incorporate some aspects of your life or the experiences of other people you knew during your life into your stories. Could you talk about that and maybe give an example and why you do that?
Sure. Well, I think there are different kinds of writers, of course, but some people are working with, you know, vampires and wizards and stuff. And there are some great books that have those elements. For me, I love realistic fiction. I sometimes describe it as, I don't even know if I'm writing books or plagiarizing the world. I think there are incredible stories out there that all my job is to just filter them into, you know, the written word. Why is it interesting to me? Because I think working class characters are underrepresented in fiction, especially children's literature. There aren't enough working class kids, and there aren't enough diverse characters. So I think, for me, it's very important to provide those stories to young kids growing up. I think it's powerful to see yourself in a book, but also to be acknowledged. Your life is relevant and just as important as the traditional characters we see.
There was, in the media this past year, a story about a young, I think, African-American girl who noticed that the lack of diversity, the lack of students or people who look like her in the book she was reading.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with that project?
I am. It's what a powerful gesture when it comes from a young person. So it's not an adult looking down and taking care of young people. It's a young person in the field growing up saying, hey, something's not right here. That was a pretty powerful gesture.
Yeah, she noticed that the characters in the book she was being given to read didn't represent her, and
yep,
she set out to to change that for herself and other young people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. You've largely written young adult literature, mm-hmm. yet your most recent book, Last Stop on Market Street, which won the Newbery Award, by the way, for our listeners, if they don't know that, congratulations.
Thank you.
Was designed for younger readers,
yes.
either for younger children to read or for adults to read to young children because it was a picture book. Why did you switch? Why did you write a picture book after writing young adult literature?
Well, I think what I almost equate it to being an offensive coordinator in football. Sorry, I speak in sports metaphors sometimes, but you know, you design a play, and then you come up with the right running back to facilitate the play. And I think it's the same thing when you come up with a story idea. What is the right age group for this story idea? Originally, some of the things I explore in Last Stop on Market Street, I was considering for a young adult novel. But then I had this image of a boy on the bus with his grandmother,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know where his parents were, and I thought, oh my gosh, some of these things could fit into this storyline. This boy, where's he going? You know, what's his background? So for me, it fit just for a younger audience. And there are a couple reasons why the younger books are kind of speaking to me right now. First of all, I have a 2-year-old, and I just am amazed when I sit down with her and we read books. To watch her mind just expand right in front of me. She's in this stage where I finish a book and she immediately wants me to read it again and again and again.
Right.
And you're just watching her notice different parts of mm-hmm. the book. It's the pictures. Then it's the music of the text. So I think it's really, really amazing the things that I see happening in picture books today. And then there's another thing. A lot of people say, was it a big shift going from novels to picture books? And in a weird way, it's like going home because I grew up writing spoken word poetry. And when I look at a picture book text, I just see it as a spoken word poem. And then a talented illustrator comes in, tells a visual story underneath and around my textual story, and it becomes bigger and better than anything I had imagined.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the children's book you're saying is because of the kind of the simplicity of the words in it and the sheer volume of text is left less. And because it's often read aloud, it has a rhythm.
Yes.
So it's kind of akin to spoken word.
Yeah,
poetry.
I mean, for me, when I write a picture book, I have 2 jobs. I have to get the story right and then I have to get the music right. And it's no different than writing a song to me. Like when you're using words to make music, it's not that different than using an instrument. You know, it's about sounds and rhythms and internal rhymes. And, you know, it can be a beautiful thing when it's read out loud. So my goal is to try to make the oral version of my text musical, but not too musical, mm-hmm. like not just a traditional ABAB rhyme scheme, but just internal rhymes. Very informed by spoken word poetry and hip hop.
Okay, did you want to read anything to us from a book?
I would. I don't know if I have a book here.
Okay,
I don't have a book with me.
Okay,
sadly.
All right. So Isaac knew that you were a basketball player as well, and you mentioned sports being big.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to ask him anything about that, Isaac?
Yeah, I guess. You talked about you got to play Steve Nash earlier, who's like probably the best Canadian basketball player ever to play the NBA. What was that like?
You know, it's interesting because we played he was a little older than me, and we played in college. We both went to smaller Division I schools in Northern California. And don't get me wrong, he was a great player in college, and, you know, he kind of kicked my butt. I'm not going to lie. We were both point guards. But I never thought that he would go to the pros and be as good as he was. I mean, he was a 2-time MVP. He became my favorite player to watch. So it's actually kind of a testament to him that he went from a great player in college who I thought was going to sort of max out
mm-hmm.
Or cap out in college and maybe be a serviceable backup in the pros. And he became an incredible professional player. So I'm kind of curious about how he did that. Another cool thing about him is when he got to the NBA, he got really, really into reading. So he was a big reader, always reading a book. So I kind of admire him on a couple fronts.
That's cool. Do you still follow basketball today?
Oh, yeah. I'm a diehard.
Yeah?
When the Warriors lost, I was destroyed.
Because you're from Southern California.
Yeah. And plus, I just love good shooting, and I love good offense, and I could care less about defense. they used to call me Matt No De La Pena in college. But no, I think when I saw the final game in that series, like, it made me happy for Cleveland that they won a championship.
Finally.
But I did love Golden State.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I totally follow it, for sure.
Yeah. And another thing that you mentioned, another connection kind of between sports and writing that you mentioned yesterday in your talk, was the idea of repetition and practice and just working more to get things right.
It's so true. I mean, I think so much of what I do in the world of writing comes from sports, which is very odd. You know, most of my writer friends hate sports or, you know, never participate in sports. And in a weird way, you almost feel like an outsider coming in as a former basketball player.
Mm-hmm.
But I think...
Right, you're not an intellectual. Exactly,
and you're not an artiste. But I think, really, I mean, work ethic is a big deal to me. So I try to outwork, you know, what I think I can do. I try to work harder than I think I can work. But another thing is, in order to get a sentence right, I turn over every rock. So if I write a sentence, I'll try every different combination of those words. I'll try different words, different verbs, and I'll try, like, I don't know, maybe 25 different versions of that sentence. Even if I end up going back to the original sentence, I need to know that the other versions weren't better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that comes from, you know, working in a gym and shooting over and over and over, trying to, like, perfect your jump shot.
In your talk yesterday, I was also a bit surprised that you said that you don't really have an aim or a goal in writing the kinds of books that you do. Because you certainly address issues of race and class in your books. As a former high school teacher and now a professor in the School of Ed, I would refer to your books as social justice books.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, they're getting people thinking about inequity and injustice in society. So do you really not write with the hope that you're going to effect some kind of social change?
I think the minute you come in with an agenda or, like, an ideology, I think you kill the literary merit of your work. So I think the way I like to describe it is, my job as a writer is not to provide answers, but to ask the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, you're right. I'm sort of doing work in this field, but I'm not trying to provide answers. And I'm not trying to come in with, you should think about this. These are just things that really, really interest me as one single person. And in exploring them on the page and not trying to come up with answers, but just exploring a question, I think people can use those books as tools to do the work you're talking about, which is possibly affect social change or at least open people's eyes. But my job as a writer is mostly to get the story right. And I do think it's such a collaboration between writer and reader. I sort of put the story down and the reader figures out what it means. So I don't come in with meaning before. I think that would crush the exploration that I'm trying to do.
Like, be too heavy-handed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Didactic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope you don't mind that that's the way I'm using them.
No, I think that's your job.
At least that's what I try to do. I try to present them to students like that. One of your books, he also knew was made into a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Ball Don't Lie.
Yeah.
What was it like turning that into, like, a screenplay? And then were you involved with the production and stuff like that?
I got to go to the shooting, one day of shooting. I guess there were 22 days of shooting. I got to see one. And it was the most boring day of my life. It was like 16 hours of just nothing happening. I met Ludacris, who's in the movie, and I feel like we're really tight now. Our conversation was like this. He was with his posse.
Oh, yeah.
And he came up to me, and the director said, "Hey, Luda, this is Matt. He wrote the book." And he looked at me and he said, "You wrote the book?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "That's cool." And then he took off. So we're pretty tight now. But it was really strange because when you write a novel, you're alone in a room. Nobody's there. You're like sad and alone. And then when you see that story be made into a visual story, there are like hundreds of people working. There are people pulling cables. There are people serving food and on the craft service table. And it's like such a production, and you're like, wow, like this is such a different form of storytelling. But it was overwhelming. I think one of the most important things for me is, you know, they give you a good chunk of money to get out of the way, which helps you pay off your credit cards. So that was kind of vital for me. I think what I learned is that the movie version of your book is a different story. It's not your story exactly. It's the visual version of that director's mindset. Mm-hmm. And so really, if you want a movie to be just like the book you love, you're in for a rude awakening.
Right.
So it's not going to happen because it's just a different medium. Overall, it was an incredible experience, and I learned so much about movies. And I did get to co-write the script with the director.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think one of my biggest learning experiences there is he said, "Matt, why don't you do the first pass?" So I did, and my first draft of the script was, I think, 200 pages. And if you know scripts, it's supposed to be around 90. So he was like, "Wow, we have to cut this in half." So I learned what you take out of a script, what is left to interpretation of the actors, the directors, the cinematographer. I learned all the stuff that isn't in the script. So it was a real big learning experience. I think it actually informs my novels, what I learned from script writing.
And that was your first book.
It was my first book. And so, I was like,
"That's crazy!
Wow, all my books are going to be made into a movie." I was like, this is just the way it goes. But obviously,
haven't happened again. Well, I think they're great stories in and of themselves. So even if they don't get made into movies, I think that it's really wonderful for people to read them. And now that you're writing for different age levels of young people, it brings those ideas and those stories to even more people.
Thank you.
And the library has them, so check them out at our public library.
And the librarians are cool over there. That's another thing I learned yesterday. Really cool librarians.
Yeah, and we have a good collaboration with the library. So thank you so much for coming in today. We've been talking with Matt de la Peña, the author of The Last Stop on Market Street, which won the Newbery Award. And now you're off to Cedar Rapids.
Yep, I'm going to go make that drive. And I just want to say the people in Iowa are so nice. It's been such a pleasure being here. So thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you having you in.
Welcome back. This is Local Talk on KHOI Radio. That was some piano music by Scott Joplin to get us ready for my next segment. Recently, I had the chance to talk with Patricia Izbicki about the new public piano project coming to Ames. There's two pianos that will be put in the community for anyone to come and play on, and they will be an added element to the already booming music scene here in Ames. Izbicki is currently studying the neuroscience of music at Iowa State, which we also discussed during the interview, and she hopes the public pianos can help keep people upbeat throughout the day as they provide another outlet for creativity. You said that you got your undergrad degree from Florida, and you're originally from there.
Yes, so I got my undergrad at University of West Florida. It's more kind of on the west side of the panhandle.
Mm-hmm. What were you studying there?
So I was studying music performance, specifically piano performance, with some harpsichord intertwined on the side, and I was also doing biology and chemistry as well.
So then what made you want to come further your education here at Iowa State?
So it kind of happened in a strange way. I met someone that knew my professor, and they were telling me about what she did, what kind of research she did. So this is Dr. Elizabeth Segemuller, and she does research with music on the brain, specifically how music can help people with Parkinson's disease. And that was something that I was interested in pursuing, the therapeutic clinical implications of music on the brain and generally the nervous system. So that's what attracted me here. And fortunately, the neuroscience program accepted me, and I'm here.
Congrats.
Thank you.
And now you're teaching, you teach a class about the neuroscience of music too as well?
Yes. So this is through the Office of Precollegiate Programs for Talented and Gifted, or the acronym usually we know that as OPTAG. And so they agreed to offer this course, the Neuroscience of Music course, to grades, to students who are in grades 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. So right now that is the age group I'm teaching towards, but hopefully in the future, way down the line, I would definitely like to offer this for either high school or undergrad.
That'd be cool. I guess, can you explain a little bit about what the neuroscience of music is? Like, explain that a bit for people.
So, the class specifically?
Or just in general, that whole study, like, what it involves.
So, generally, I'll start with the course. Maybe the course, I've laid out a few topics that are relevant, I guess, to how music impacts the brain. So, first we go through how sound is processed in the brain, because you have to be able to hear the sound
right,
to be able to have any sort of effect. So we go a little bit through the basics of how sound is going through the ear and how is it later on turned into signals we actually understand in the brain.
Okay.
And then we go through how music can cause neuroplasticity in the brain and how does that actually happen? What are the mechanisms? And we also talk about the lab techniques that we use in our lab. So we use transcranial magnetic stimulation. We use EEG.
What's that?
So transcranial magnetic stimulation is TMS. We also use acronyms. You see, we use a lot of acronyms in
the
science.
Big of words.
Yeah, two big words. So it's essentially a device that emits a magnetic pulse, and depending on where you position this pulse on the brain, you can stimulate certain areas. So, for example, if you position it looks essentially like a figure eight coil, and it's a magnetic coil. And if you position that on a certain part of your brain, for example, the part of the brain that's involved in hand movement, you can emit that magnetic pulse, and what it'll cause is a twitch in your hand.
Oh, wow.
So you can also do that. There's a part of your brain that's responsible for your leg movement, so you can do it for your leg. So, it sounds a little bit science fiction, but it's very safe and
cool.
You know, scientists all over the world use it. And it's a very, very unique and novel device. Not every institution has something like this, so we're very fortunate here to be able to start doing studies like that and not be involved with a med school. So it's very exciting.
Nice. So then, you're teaching younger kids right now. What exactly do you guys focus on then with the class?
So it was the same topics that I was talking about earlier. I introduced all of these topics to them, and obviously at a little bit of a less intense level than we do with undergrads and in the graduate school, right? Because that would be way too much material, and they are just beginning to learn and understand all of this. So we talk about neurons, the cells of in your brain and in the nervous system. We do. How are they connected to one another? We talk about that. How many cells are actually in the human brain? Just very, very intro-based things, because usually they've had some kind of introduction at school, but not very neuro-based.
Okay, that makes sense. So then, growing up, were you always playing an instrument? And was music always just like a big part of you as a person?
I definitely. So my family, my dad loved music, and so music was always around the house. And I remember seeing, I think, my friend play on piano one time, and I told my parents, like, I want to do that, right? That looks really cool. Like, I want to be able to play that. And it was just funny because there are no musicians in our family. So when I think back on it, it's kind of weird how I got into it. But I just saw someone play, and I really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, throughout my younger years, I wasn't perhaps as serious as some other kids my age. But when I, as I got older, and especially once I got into high school, I really enjoyed playing much more. It was very stress relieving, and I don't know, kind of things happened in a weird way. I ended up majoring in college, had a wonderful professor, and here I am now studying how it impacts the brain. So
awesome. So other than keeping busy with teaching your class and everything like that and studying, you have this plan to bring in some public pianos to the Ames community?
Yes. So the public piano project is kind of coinciding. So one of the pianos, actually the OPTAG Neuroscience of Music course, is painting. And so that's exciting, and that's almost, I think it'll be done tomorrow. So
oh, nice.
Tomorrow, Thursday, I don't know what the date, the 30th, June 30th, it'll be done tomorrow, and we'll just have to put a waterproofing coat over it. So that course was responsible for one of the pianos, and then the second piano will be the music camp at First Baptist Church of Ames. They will be painting the other piano, and that will be occurring the second week of July. So by mid-July, both of the pianos should be ready to go.
That's super exciting. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that they have to waterproof them and paint them. Are there any other steps that you have to do to keep them, like, prepared up for the environment when they're sitting out there?
Yep. So we have to put a waterproof coat on there on the piano, and also we will be putting custom designed tarps for each piano, and that's essentially that's what they've done in a lot of cities. There are different ways that you could do it. For example, there's actually a piano technician out in Boone. He did his own piano where he was able to make the keys waterproof and inside the whole piano waterproof without any kind of tarp put over it. But I am not a piano technician. And what he did is it's absolutely amazing. And
yeah,
there's very talented and very time consuming. And unfortunately, it's with kids and me not really having a piano technician background, I kind of went the easier route. And other cities have done the same thing with the tarps. So it seems to work in other places in big cities. And I'm like, if it can work there, then it could possibly work in Ames.
Okay. Where do you have to go to get those tarps then?
So the tarps are going to be made in Iowa City. There's a business there that has done the tarps for Des Moines, for Denver, for Iowa City, in terms of their own public piano. So they have experience in that, and it's just providing the correct measurements. And they said that they will be good to go. So
are they just like normal tarps, or is there something special about them that makes them like stronger?
So I mean, I know the tarps are made of a material that's used on some semi-trucks, so I don't know if that's regular tarp material, but whatever it is, it's going to be very strong, and it should hopefully withstand any kind of weather ailments that happen.
Okay, that's good. So then for besides water, what happens during the winter then when it gets cold and it snows?
Right. Yeah. So it's funny because when I did this previous in Florida, obviously we don't have to worry about the winter, right? But here what we're going to possibly do is one of the pianos fortunately has found a winter home at London Underground. And so we're very excited about that. And then the other piano is still looking for a home for the winter, whether it be on Main Street or finding just a permanent home after the season is done is still kind of up in the air.
Okay.
But yes, the second piano will have to find some home. So if anyone is interested, contact me, please.
It needs a home.
Yes.
How did you come up with this idea? Like, where did it come from?
So I think I mentioned just really briefly before, I did this project with my professor, Dr. Hedy Solanki, back at University of West Florida. Mm-hmm. And she was involved in putting pianos in the Pensacola community. And I was I helped with some of the painting, and I kind of observed how she was carrying out the project. So I kind of secondhandedly learned from what she had to go through and how the painting worked and all of the logistics. So I had the experience to
That's try. Always good.
Yeah, try a project on my own here.
Okay. So what kind of pianos are you bringing to the town then, like size-wise and things like that?
So the one right now that's getting painted by the Neuroscience of Music course is a Yamaha console spinet, and it's kind of like a spinet piano, so it's a little bit smaller than an upright.
Okay.
And then the second piano will be a big upright, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be cool.
So, I don't know if I'm mixing terms up, but more like a parlor, a big parlor piano that you see in the old-timey bars and
yeah.
things like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where did you go to find the pianos and, like, get them?
So it actually was the easiest part out of the whole the whole project. The smaller piano, the Yamaha console, was donated by Dr. James Cornett, who's actually a professor emeritus over, I believe, in the Department of Mathematics. And I found him on Craigslist because they were giving the piano away for free, which I'm surprised
That's
by
crazy.
How many people give away free pianos. And he agreed. I told him about the project and asked him, you know, this won't be going into a home, but it'll be going out in public. And he seemed very excited. His family seemed very excited about it. And so that's how I found the first one, Craigslist.
That's awesome.
I'm very thankful for that. And then the second one, First Baptist Church of Ames, is somewhere where I accompany on piano for the church choir. And they were saying, we really never use this piano, and we would love for it to go out in the community. So they were very gracious in letting me use that for the music camp for the kids there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very excited. It was a lot easier, that portion.
Yeah.
I was very scared about, if no one will donate their piano, I don't. That's not going to happen, right?
And then you mentioned that was the easiest part. So then what other steps did you have to take to, like, make sure this was allowed or, like, could happen?
Mm-hmm. So I initially began my conversations with Julie Johnston over at Ames Parks and Recreation.
Okay.
Because I wanted to start somewhere, and she was just someone that I knew, and she sounded very excited about the project, because I wanted to know, first of all, would the city even be interested, and
yeah.
the community, would they be interested in having something like this? So I pitched my idea. I went to one of the Parks and Recreation committee meetings. They seemed very interested, and eventually also contacted the Main Street Cultural District and the Public Arts Commission and just let them know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also applied for a grant through the Iowa State Focus Artist. And they were very excited about it and gave me the grant also to pursue this project. So
okay.
it was really getting support from all parts of the community, mm-hmm. including the university, to be able to pursue this. So it just then they gave me a set of things that they wanted to know, like the weatherproofing, where the piano would go, and
mm-hmm.
it just takes time and research and answering all of the questions and settling and talking to just a lot of people
yeah.
in the city and the community, really. And I mean, if you pursue enough, it'll happen. and again, the Focus Artist Grant and has helped tremendously, because they are the ones mm-hmm. financially supporting this project.
That's
in terms
awesome.
Of moving, getting the materials, getting the tarps. So that's very, very important, because right now, as a graduate student, I cannot be able to do this on my own.
Yeah.
So it's very, very it's great. I've been lucky to have good support.
That's awesome. Do you know where you plan on placing these pianos?
Yes. So I don't know which piano will go where yet,
okay.
but we're hoping, and I will know more details tomorrow, actually, about when and exactly when those pianos will be there and which piano will go where. So one of
okay.
the pianos will go in Tom Evans Plaza/Park. So that will be on Main Street. So one of them will be there, and then the other one will be possibly at Campus Town Court.
Okay, nice.
So I think that's, I forget the intersection of Welch and another street. I cannot
remember. I'm not very sure about my Ames streets, to be honest.
Yeah, but it's closer, a little bit closer towards the stomping grounds and then the fire station in that area.
Okay, I know what you're talking about then. So the pianos being like out in the community, do you think this ties back in with the whole neuroscience and music thing? Do you think maybe if someone's like walking by, it'll like maybe change their day up a little bit if they're just hearing some live music out there?
Definitely. I mean, so the biggest thing that I would like to see out of this project is for a little bit for the community to enjoy the music and visual arts scene in Ames a little bit more and be aware, oh, wow, that these things exist, but also to be able to tie the science back into that and be able to talk to people, at least have them be aware that there is that connection between the sciences and the arts. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we see maybe not in Iowa because Iowa actually has a very good educational system.
Yeah.
But in other places, I mean, there's like in Florida, the arts are experiencing such a big budget cut. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure other states are experiencing that as well. And so if we're able to really show that these two are intertwined, because one, if as a scientist, you're also an artist because you're designing your own experiments.
Right.
You have to think creatively. What can I do that no one else has done before?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, but also, if you go back as an artist, you're thinking scientifically, for example, in music. I mean, first of all, you have to decode an entire language that they're
crazy.
Writing the music for, right? You have to really listen for specific tones. You have to mathematically be able to feel and read the rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much, you know, different things. Even in visual arts, you have to know your geometry, you know, have to know how the lines fit and things like that. So, I mean, there's so much interconnection, and that's a big point that I want to make in this project, if I can, that those two are really uniquely intertwined.
Thanks for that segment, Isaac. That's really interesting. We'll look forward to hearing those pianos.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Yeah, thanks. This is Local Talk on KHOI, and we just heard about a public piano project that's going to be starting in Ames. And now we've been joined by Susan Guiazda, the Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. Thanks for being here, Susan.
Good morning.
For your monthly segment. It's July, and there's a lot going on with 4th of July coming up. And, of course, because it's summer, we also have road construction going on. So we also welcome Rudy Castor, who will be giving us a street construction update. It's great to have you here as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So should we begin with the road update?
I think the road update is what everybody
that's what's
wants
everyone
to hear
waiting
about.
To hear.
The street talk, as we're calling it.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
So we're definitely, underway with construction here in Ames. We have several projects that are currently under construction. As you can see, there's 13th Street. There's a 6th Street Bridge the contractors are working away on completing those projects. But we're also wrapping up some projects as well. So we're actually checking some off the list, which is a great feeling
to have,
of accomplishment. But then we're also kicking off some new projects here this month. Dotson Drive, we'll be doing a reconstruction on a portion there just on the west side of the Hy-Vee complex out in West Ames.
I saw signs up for that just yesterday starting.
We'll be starting on Monday with some utility work, and then we'll proceed into
Tuesday.
Excuse me, the 4th is Monday. Yes. So Tuesday, July 5th, we'll be starting that with a street closure and some utility repairs there, and then proceed into street reconstruction. And then we'll actually kind of work our way into that neighborhood. We're calling it the Wellens area, which involves Bauman Street, Beetle, Applin, Wellens Circle and Drive, Harris Street, and Jeffrey Lane. So quite an extensive improvement to that neighborhood that will be kind of be there for a while the next few weeks coming up. So
that's a new neighborhood, and so it even relatively new neighborhoods need updates, I guess.
Yeah, it's
newish.
Newish. As you work your way south towards the middle school, that's fairly new developed. The kind of area we're in is pushing a couple decades old. So yes, the streets are needing some attention. So that's one project, and then we're also kind of kicking off, we did this past week, Friley Road reconstruction there, and we're proceeding into pavement removal and replacement next week as well. North 2nd Street, north of Lincoln Way between North Riverside and North Hazel is currently closed and under construction as well. The contractor is making great project progress on the utility repairs, and then we'll proceed into repaving of that street as well. So there's quite a bit happening in Ames. A couple projects to kind of keep on everyone's mind that will be starting up later this summer and into the fall would be Clark Avenue between Main Street and Lincoln Way will be a reconstruction project that'll do a two-phase closure on that. And then we'll actually be doing some reconstruction on some intakes on the Mortensen Parkway just west of University, which will require a closure temporarily.
And what's an intake?
That would be basically a structure that takes the stormwater off of the pavement.
Okay.
During those rains. The water has to go somewhere so that that structure takes the stormwater and eventually it outfalls to our local rivers and streams. So a couple extra depth intakes there that are just a little too deep for our repair crews to go after. So basically needing a contractor to come in with more larger equipment, more with the capability of doing that work. So
the big ones that seem to affect people are 6th Street.
Yes.
And 13th Street near
yes.
the Aquatic Center
yes.
entrance.
Very
are
high
those
visible.
Making good progress?
We are making great progress. They just completed the retaining wall on 13th Street and now have removed the pavement on the north lane of that section of street. So they're looking to get in there and grade and hopefully pave here within the next few weeks. They'll be making progress on that. And 6th Street, they just completed the street paving. So they'll be working on the shared use path and the sidewalk paving here in the weeks to come of July. And then we're still looking great for that August 1st opening.
That will be welcomed.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. So most of these projects are because the road itself needs repair or the drainage system, like you were saying.
Yeah.
So these have nothing to do with utilities or anything like that. This is like road maintenance.
It's actually both.
Both.
We do look at the utilities that are below the pavement.
Okay.
You know, if they do need to be repaired or replaced, we do address those as well. Basically kind of putting those into one project, so we're only impacting
okay.
the residents, you know, one time around if we can. We're very, we listen for any input that maybe we're not aware of that individuals that live in a neighborhood that they see regular problems because they're there every day. You know, we ask for them to provide those at our public input meetings that we have for these projects as we prepare for putting together plans and ultimately hiring a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely work months and months in advance trying to get that information and gather that, whether it's local knowledge from the residents or the records that we have on our files that we can put together a complete set of plans and ultimately have a successful project and a very aesthetically pleasing street at the end.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, well, I know it's a... probably a thankless task, but thank you.
Okay. And then one last project. This is an Iowa DOT-led project, the Grand Avenue repaving and resurfacing they're doing there. So I drove through that a few days ago this week, and they're making progress. They have the west half done, so they're on the east half, have that pavement removed, doing their concrete repairs, and then they're repaving that. So.
And that's up near 24th in
yep.
that area, is
yep.
that correct?
I believe they started near Murray and are kind of the north terminus would be close to 28th Street, so that
okay.
the mall. So,
yeah.
yep, exactly.
Yeah. So one more question. Do you know the name and location of every street in Ames? Because it sounds like you do.
I have a fairly good knowledge on that, but I don't know every street. There's too many to just keep
wow.
in memory.
It's impressive.
Thank you.
It's like if somebody's lost and they stop you, they're in luck.
They very well could be, yes.
Yeah. Okay, anything else you want to let people know about?
Definitely follow our city construction update webpage,
okay.
www.cityofames.org/construction. You can get our current updates on projects that are under construction. So
okay.
check it out.
And can people put comments there too?
I believe they can, yes.
Okay, all right. We'll put a link to that on our website when
much
we post this show. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Rudy.
Thank you.
And Susan, now we'll turn to you. 4th of July, big doings.
Yeah, 4th of July is coming up. It seems like it's early this year, but it's always on the 4th, isn't it? Nice 3-day weekend.
Yeah.
Of course, City Hall and most city offices will be closed, but we still invite you to come down on Monday, July 4th at 8:30 for pancakes The Ames Mayor Ann Campbell, along with city council members, will be helping to serve pancakes in front of City Hall from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m.
And then that's outside.
Outside, rain or shine. We have tents up, and it's rained before, and we've still had a nice, happy crowd enjoying pancakes. Our City of Ames Water and Pollution Control Department will be on hand. It is their 125th anniversary of the water utility here in Ames. Mm-hmm. So they'll be providing information, talking with people, and, of course, providing water. We're very proud of our water here in Ames. Mm-hmm. It tastes delicious, ice cold, and it's always delicious on a morning when you're in waiting in line.
Yeah, or waiting for the parade.
Yeah, it really is a nice event. It's a great opportunity to meet your neighbors, talk to your council members, and after pancakes, the 4th of July parade begins at 11 a.m., so it all works together pretty nicely. A great morning to spend downtown. And then again, of course, City Hall and most city departments will be closed on Monday, July 4th, but everything reopens again on Tuesday, July 5th. And when Rudy was talking about 6th Street, it reminded me that the skate park on 6th Street, right across, adjacent to Brookside Park, will be undergoing repairs. So if you have skaters in your family, or you're a skater yourself, and you like to skateboard, remember the skate park will close on Monday, July 11th. There's a series of improvements, added amenities that will be going on. Mm. It will close for 4 to 6 weeks while they basically give it a facelift. And I think it will be something worth waiting for. A company out of Los Angeles, California, will be coming in and doing those improvements. So exciting for skaters. But I understand, you know, the timing could be better. It's kind of prime skating season. So sometimes this is a busy time for contractors. I think Rudy would agree with me. They have a lot on their plate, and you have to take them when they'll come.
Okay.
So skate park closed beginning Monday, July 11th for 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
Another thing I wanted to mention was, and I've talked about it before on the show, but we are really gearing up for what we're calling the Rummage Rampage. It's a big community-wide garage sale based on an event in Iowa City. It's really focused on students, and it's going to be held at the Ames Intermodal Facility, which is 129 Hayward. Mm-hmm. It's the large parking ramp there. This is an event geared towards ISU students who are forced with this move-in, move-out dilemma at the end of July each year, where they have a lease turnover and they have to get rid of furniture quickly. What we would like to avoid in Ames is what we call the furniture dumping.
Yeah.
And so when you drive around Ames, you see, and it's really kind of, it's really sad because you see some quality things being basically abandoned because people don't have the time or the resources or the knowledge of where to get rid of them. So beginning on Friday, July 29th, we will accept items at the Ames Intermodal Facility and from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then that weekend, we'll be doing a sale. We're working with local nonprofits, and we're working with the Volunteer Center of Story County to get a sign-up sheet, basically an electronic sign-up board on the Volunteer Center of Story County's website, where nonprofit groups can volunteer labor and walk away with a cut of the proceeds. So if you're willing to put in some sweat equity, you could, based on the number of hours from your organization, you will get whatever we make on the rummage sale, a cut of that. It's a unique formula for doing this. And, again, we based it on the University of Iowa has Rummage in the Ramp, and they do something very similar. They have built theirs up over time to about 10 days. We're going to start with Friday, July 29th, ending going over the weekend, Saturday, July 30th, Sunday, July 31st. Monday, August 1st, and Tuesday, August 2nd will be like half days of sale. We're going to post those hours on our website today. Again, www.vcstory.org is where people would sign up to volunteer.
Okay.
And on our website, cityofames.org, is where you would get hours and information. So as we get through the month of July, if you have furniture in good condition, small electronics like lamps, toasters, microwaves, blenders, working television sets that are flat screen, any kind of housewares and kitchenware, that's the kind of those are the kind of items we'll be accepting at the intermodal facility. We're not interested in collecting mattresses, box springs, sheets, blankets, towels. That's not the kind of we're just not prepared or set up for those kinds of textiles, but we're really looking at getting some of that furniture off the streets and back into the hands of people who could use it.
Mm-hmm.
Tables, those kinds of things, chairs.
Upholstered furniture?
Yeah, we will take upholstered furniture, and there are concerns about upholstered furniture, but just like in any garage sale, I would encourage people to inspect things carefully and, you know, treat them in any way that you think might be necessary. A garage sale is kind of what you see is what you
same
get.
Thing, What do you think, Isaac? You think students will be interested in this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea because I've seen stuff that's like brand new, just left out all the time. And I'm one of those people who has like my lease ending up at the end of July, so I know the pain that's happening.
Yeah, and we're kind of just focusing on that the end of July, but we were told that once you move into your new place, then you realize, hey, I need an end table, or I don't have a chair for this party.
Or my roommate had all the pots.
Yeah, so that's why we were kind of encouraged to go into August. So August 1st is a Monday, noon to 6, and August 2nd, noon to 4. Just a few extra hours on those days to see.
Yeah.
And again, we're relying on volunteers to fill these slots, so those hours may be in flux a bit. But it's our first year, and we hope it's the first year of many years for this event. We're really excited to be doing this.
Okay. One thing you didn't mention about 4th of July was fireworks. Could you remind us when and where they are?
Yes. So even though this is the third year of doing fireworks on July 3rd, we still get people who forget. And there is a the fireworks are July 3rd.
Okay.
They'll be set off from around Jack Trice Stadium. Ryman Gardens is open at no charge that evening, so you can watch from there. The 16th Street entrance to Ryman Gardens is closed for some repair work to the parking lot there. So you have to enter Ryman Gardens from Beach. So just, you know, plan ahead and just remember that there may be a detour in that area if you go the wrong way. But again, July 3rd. And, you know, there are lots of places to see the fireworks.
Right.
I have found many locations in the community where you can see them, just depending on how close you like to get. It's a different experience, and some people like to go back to the same place every time, and other people like to try new locations. But dusk on the 3rd, it's usually 9:30 or so before it really gets dark enough for those fireworks
for them
to shoot off.
Okay.
And we expect a great show again. There is some economy of doing these on the 3rd. You know, every community wants to do fireworks on the 4th, and there's only a certain number of companies that are able to produce a fireworks show.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually do stretch our dollars. We get a better show.
Any last-minute thing you want to tell us?
Well, as you know, as many people know, our water department has been monitoring water in the community of Ames for a long time. We had a press conference in May identifying some homes in Ames that had lead water service lines, which is the private connection between the home and the Ames water main. We asked those people if they were concerned to bring in their water for sampling. Mm-hmm. We had 31 homes participate. And, of course, as we had hoped and as we expected, all those tests came back with below the action level for any kind of lead detection in there. So we just sent that information out yesterday that our monitoring program revealed very low lead levels. People want more information on that is at cityofames.org/lead. You can get any information on that, including the lead map that shows properties that we are that might be in question.
Okay, great. So thanks very much for joining us. We've been talking with Susan Guiazda and Rudy Castor from the City of Ames. And we'll see you both next month?
Absolutely.
Probably, because construction will still be going on.
We'll still be going strong.
Okay, very, very good. We're ready to wrap it up.
All right, this is KHY Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk with Isaac Beal and my co-host Gail Seiler. Thanks to Matt De La Pena, Patricia Izbicki, Susan Guiazda, and Rudy Castor, our guests today, both in the studio and pre-recorded.
Local Talk is a broadcast of KHOI, and we're on at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you'll find contact information and links for the people and places we talked about. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
KHOY is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. You can become a member or donate at any time, and you do that on our website, khoyfm.org. Just look for the donate button. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show, which means you can be a part of our team of volunteers and producers and reporters. If you would like to join the team, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or through our website, khoyfm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.